Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Kabuki Theatre. Following the rejection of Vladimir Putin's call to postpone a referendum by the pro-Russian secessionists, Putin claims not to control that his GRU and Spetsnaz have organized. Kevin Platt, a professor of Slavic studies at the University of Pennsylvania and author of History in a Grotesque Key, Russian Literature and the Idea of Revolution, joins us to discuss how Putin is playing the role of both the arsonist and the fire brigade while delaying sanctions and continuing to destabilize Ukraine. Then we'll speak with Mike Lofgren, a 28-year veteran House and Senate senior staffer who is the author of The Party is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted, and an important essay at BillMoyers.com, Anatomy of the Deep State. He joins us to discuss a whole new level of election year theater of the absurd with Thursday's resolution to establish a House Select Committee to investigate Benghazi for the fifth time and Wednesday's partisan vote by House Republicans to hold an IRS official in contempt for exercising her rights under the Fifth Amendment. Then finally, we will look into a revival of polio, a crippling disease that was all but eradicated due to a vaccine, but is now an epidemic the World Health Organization is declaring an international public health emergency. Seth Mnookin, the associate director of MIT's graduate program in science writing and author of The Panic Virus, The True Story Behind the Vaccine Autism Controversy, joins us to discuss how a bogus, discredited theory that vaccinating children causes autism has contributed to the revival of polio, measles, and whooping cough, and that the actress Jenny McCarthy and Oprah Winfrey, not to mention Pacifica Radio, should be held accountable for spreading irresponsible conspiracy theories. And joining us now is Kevin Platt, who's a professor of Slavic languages and literature and graduate chair of the Comparative Literature Program at the University of Pennsylvania. His books include Terror and Greatness, Ivan and Peter as Russian Myths, and History in a Grotesque Key, Russian Literature and the Idea of Revolution. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kevin Platt.
Thank you, Ian.
And Kevin, it looks as if there's a kind of kabuki theater going on here now with Russian President Vladimir Putin saying that he doesn't really have much influence over the pro-Russian separatists in the south and east of Ukraine, and that he doesn't think it's a good idea to go ahead with the referendum scheduled for this weekend. And lo and behold, the pro-Russian self-declared secessionists in the east and south of Ukraine have said they are going to go ahead, which, of course, reinforces Putin's point. At the same time, the places are awash with GRU and Spetsnaz people that Putin has put in there. So do you see this as sort of a cynical theater?
I don't, actually. I think that, you know, on the one hand, the place is certainly awash with all kinds of representatives of the Russian special forces who have been mobilizing and radicalizing the Russian-speaking, ethnic Russian-identified populations of the east of Ukraine. On the other hand, this is, as it has been christened by the media, hybrid warfare, which involves both operatives and representatives of the state under direct orders and local populations, which are mobilized to take actions on their own behalf. And I think it's undoubtable that the people that have been mobilized in the, you know, southeast of Ukraine in these pro-Russian secessionist movements definitely believe and are moved by a sincere passion to support the idea that their future lies with some kind of an independence or a full independence or autonomy or more probably precisely with Russia. Yet one has to keep in mind that I think the Kremlin's politics here are entirely cynical. I doubt that Putin wants as his end result of this entire undertaking in eastern Ukraine responsibility for eastern Ukraine, to pay for its bills, to take it on board as a part of the Russian Empire. In this sense, his goals, I think, are, you know, far different from those of the people that he has mobilized on the ground. So that on the one hand, you know, about a week ago, everyone was opening their mouths in wonder at the, you know, amazing efficiency of the Russian strategy in eastern Ukraine to achieve all kinds of ends, which no one could have predicted a month ago. Whereas on the other hand, I think we're seeing here the weaknesses of this so-called hybrid warfare, that when people aren't under your command, they're going to do things that you didn't tell them to do, and perhaps which are directly contradictory to your strategies. I mean, in the end, Putin, I think, could care less for the actual population of eastern Ukraine. He does not have any interest in protecting the rights of Russians, ethnic Russians, from anything. He's interested in great power politics.
So then all of these talk about Novorossiya, new Russia, and taking back the USSR, and what a catastrophe it was to the collapse of the USSR, and the notion that he'd be interested in moving to protect the Russian minorities in the Baltics. You don't see that as a possibility.
Well, I think that it's a cynical piece of rhetoric that Putin has deployed in order to shake up the world order and to change the sort of the game with regard to Russia's ability to project power into Eastern Europe, into what Russia calls the near abroad, the sort of ring of states, former Soviet states, which surrounds Russia. It also relates to domestic politics. You know, Russia's approval rate, Putin's approval ratings following the 2011-2012 protest movement were falling. They hadn't fallen low by Western standards, but they had fallen low by Putin standards to 63% as of last spring. Now they're up at 80%. So one has to draw certain conclusions about the power and attractiveness of this conception of Russian victimhood, which is being corrected now by the move to reclaim a position of great power in the world among the Russian population. People are moved by this idea of Russian patriotism. And Putin has that, I think, as his ultimate goal. It's to secure his position in Russia. It's not to reconstruct some kind of an empire which he can't pay for anyway.
Again, I'm speaking with Kevin Platt, who's Professor of Slavic Languages and Literature and Graduate Chair of the Comparative Literature Program at the University of Pennsylvania. His books include Terror and Greatness, Ivan and Peter as Russian Myths and History in a Grotesque Key, Russian Literature and the Idea of Revolution. So my understanding is that, just to buttress what you're saying, Kevin Platt, is that the Crimea is turning into a huge expanse and is likely to get even more expensive, since it depends upon electricity and water coming from Ukraine, and it's essentially landlocked, and they may have to build a bridge, you know, hugely expensive undertaking. So that certainly appears to be the case. So what is he doing? Because I've understood that he really doesn't want this election to take place.
Absolutely.
Which he's now said he does. I'm talking about the May the 25th election in Ukraine itself, not the referendum called by the secessionists in the East.
Well, I mean, it seems to me that the end goal in Ukraine is clearly to destabilize that state to the extent that Putin and his proxies in the East can generate a new structure for Ukraine, which would prevent it from ever acceding to EU in any serious way, or ever becoming a NATO member state in any serious way, so that the immediate goal is to disrupt the political processes in Ukraine to the extent that and to encourage the continuing street fighting and separatist activities in the East to the extent that will be necessary in order to, in the end, somehow, either in concert with Western powers or on his own, appear on the white horse, probably in his case, on the diplomatic white horse, dictating terms of some kind of a new settlement in terms of the political structure of Ukraine, which would allow autonomies in the East, special protections for ethnic Russians, and also special veto powers over legislation and actions taken by the center. This is the federalization of Ukraine that Putin keeps on bringing up in his speeches. With regard to the elections which are coming up, I'm certain that he wants to sort of walk this fine line to, on the one hand, allow Ukraine to persist as a state and not fall apart entirely, because then he ends up, you know, holding the bag and having to figure out what to do with Ukraine's East. At the same time, destabilizing the situation to the extent that he can always cast aspersions upon the legitimacy of that vote. The proposal that he was trying to push earlier this week was that there would be a dual vote, that certain elements of referenda concerning autonomy, independence, and so on, would be wrapped into the initial vote regarding presidents in Kiev. It seems like he's backed off on that idea, but I think the plan is to continue destabilizing the situation, casting aspersions on all of the initiatives which emanate from Kiev until he can get his way.
So he's sort of being both the arsonist and the fire brigade, right?
Absolutely. That's the role that he wants to take. He wants to, you know, control the situation. Mm-hmm. And so far, it seems like he's doing it in a fairly effective way, one has to say. It's incredibly, I think, disturbing for Western heads of state and for Western strategic thinkers to look at this situation and realize that there is, you know, very little that they can do. I think that on the diplomatic front, the effort has to be to try and engage Putin and to, you know, present him with the risk of, on the one hand, total isolation from the West, and on the other hand, economic and military expenses that he's not prepared to make. Putin seems to have become aware of that in the course of the last week and a half, and I think that's what's dictating his actions earlier this week when he backed off on his support for the secessionist movement.
Well, but if he can manipulate things and destabilize this place and basically say to the West, well, if you want to step in and take care of this basket case, you can, but keep it on a low boil, you know, obviously he's playing a game to avoid more sanctions. And this is, I think, what's behind his magnanimous gestures.
Oh, I agree. You know? I agree 100%. But of course, he also doesn't want to create a situation in which the situation spirals so far out of control that the only possible action would be peacekeeping forces there, which would inevitably involve also Western peacekeeping forces.
Right. So, well, but I think in terms of blowback to him, you've mentioned how we've already talked about how he's saddled with Crimea now, which is a big expense. But mm-hmm. taking on all of the eastern Ukraine would be even infinitely greater expense.
Absolutely. Although there are certain advantages there, too, that others have pointed out. I mean, one of the reasons that he wants to keep a hold on the sort of client relationships that tie eastern Ukraine to Russia is because there are a variety of important industries that do a lot of business with Russia located there, including business which is strategically important to him for military industrial kinds of projects. So he's got a very sort of delicate balancing act that he has to pursue if he wants to get his end result, which is a state which is still caught between, in which there is no possibility of a decisive action with regard to alignment with Europe in Kiev, and in which he can still more or less control without having the responsibility for parts of eastern Ukraine. That's the end goal that he has in mind. Crimea is going to be incredibly expensive, and incredibly expensive in Russian terms is always 10 times more expensive, as we know from the Olympics, than it would be in any normal society, just because building a bridge is going to cost not only the actual cost of building the bridge, but the cost of lining the pockets of everyone who's involved building the bridge. Building water treatment plants, the same thing. So from what we can hear about what's going on in Crimea, it seems like the sort of inevitable chaos of transforming an entire region from one economic system to another, from one currency to another, from one water supply to another, and from one economic, you know, structure to another in the course of a, you know, fortnight is coming to roost. It's a impossibly chaotic situation there. Everyone is worried about their savings. None of the banks are working. No one knows what to do with their money. It's a mess.
And this was only, what, a few months ago, they were celebrating that their standard of living was going to go up.
Yeah, it's incredibly ironic and sad, I think, for the populations who are under, who are in the firing line. Ukraine had its problems, and I think the people that went out on Maidan, they were, of course, moved by the inactivity of the Yanukovych government with regard to the EU cooperation treaty, but I think they were even more moved, many of them, simply by the inefficiency and corruption of Ukraine's successive governments, whether they've been Western-aligned or Russian-aligned. They had their problems, but still it was a functioning society. And it was also a society in which ethnic Russians and Ukrainians largely lived side by side peaceably. This whole idea of Ukraine as a divided state where there are clear and sharp divisions between a pro-Russian and a pro-Ukrainian side is really not a good representation of this society. It's a society in which there's a a large middle in which there is a intermingling of these two cultures and societies and languages, those people are not being represented at all by this polarized conflict.
But it seems in terms, the other aspect of blowback in terms of what Putin has unleashed and what he may reap, and that is, you know, I mean, first of all, I think the EU was pretty boneheaded in making this offer zero-sum situation. And then Putin turned around and made it a zero-sum situation by saying to Yanukovych, you know, you got to be with us, and it's either us or them, and it has to be us. And, you know, you keep hearing from the Russians about the encroachment of NATO heading east, which it never made a lot of sense, frankly. But he has convinced the Russian people, and they seem pretty well convinced that NATO is this malignant force that's trying to encroach on their sovereignty, when it's in fact a shell. There's nothing there. I don't think there's even any tanks in Europe at all. And isn't it possible that now NATO and the new members of NATO will in fact increase their military budgets, that Putin may actually end up creating his own nemesis?
Absolutely. I think it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, although I'm not certain that it's Putin's nemesis. I think if we think once again about Putin's situation in his domestic political scene, he is a man with very few options. There's no possibility for him to leave office in Russia. And I think he realized that some time ago, that considering the scale of the corruption and wrongdoing which has taken place under his watch, there's no one that he can trust to look out for his interests should he eventually decide to step down, which means that he needs to always develop strategies to remain in power. The sort of drop in his popularity, the rise of a seemingly well-supported, at least in the cities, protest movement, the rise of political rivals such as Navalny on the horizon, all of that made him exceedingly nervous in the past 2 years. What did he do? He developed a strategy which would allow him to create a patriotic frenzy within Russia, which has allowed him, one, to raise his approval ratings in the short term, but two, to implement all kinds of extraordinarily restrictive media and social policy, which will allow him to maintain control as long as he wants, right? With the result of the legislative procedures which have taken place, the legislative maneuvers which have taken place over the past year, and especially in the past several months, he has asserted, you know, really serious control over the internet, over the media, and over, therefore, the public opinion of his subject population in Russia. That's, I think, the key to his strategy. Creating a situation where he's confronting the West, so much the better in a certain sense for him, right? It mm-hmm. increases his possibility to peddle this idea of hostile encirclement, which threatens the Russian way of life.
Sure.
So I don't think he's that worried about NATO beefing up its right. presence in Europe. The idea that NATO would invade him, that's, of course, crazy. No one is ever going to, you know, encroach on Russian space.
Right. Well,
back to the question of NATO expansion in the first place. If I can touch on that briefly.
Very briefly, yeah.
I think that, as well as the, you know, the question of EU accession for Ukraine, and much else which has gone on in the past several years, has been, or over the past decade, you know, the NATO expansion began to take place at the end of the 90s, is indicative of a certain inability of Western actors to let go of a Cold War mentality with regard to Russia. And, of course, there is some justification in, you know, treating Russia as a, you know, not completely European society with incomplete and now dismantled civic institutions, civil society structures. Yet, I think it was a strategic error on the part of Western actors to treat Eastern Europe or the relationship with Russia as anything like a zero-sum game. The story and the approach should always have been Europe is an open society with open arms, which is ready to cooperate with Russia, and which is ready to cooperate with zones like Ukraine, which are between Russia and Europe as equal partners with Russia. It should never have been our economic zone or your economic zone.
Well, Kevin,
and I think that is a major strategic error that we are now reaping the results of.
Well, Kevin Platt, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's been a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Kevin Platt. He's a professor of Slavic languages and literature and graduate chair of the Comparative Literature Program at the University of Pennsylvania. His books include Terror and Greatness, Ivan and Peter as Russian Myths and History in a Grotesque Key, Russian Literature and the Idea of Revolution. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into this year's election year, Theater of the Absurd by the House Republicans.
From Russia with love I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mike Lofgren, who has spent 28 years working in Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate budget committees, which gave him a ringside seat on TARP, Hurricane Katrina disaster relief, debates on the Pentagon budget, and the amazing antics of various deficit reduction commissions. He's the author of The Party Is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. And he has an important essay at BillMoyes.com, Anatomy of the Deep State. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mike Lofgren.
Good to be here once again.
And when you wrote about how the Republicans went crazy after having had this ringside seat for so long as a senior staffer on both the House and the Senate side, it seems like, though, they're reaching a new crescendo of idiocy now with holding this IRS official in contempt, going back to the McCarthy days. And we know what will happen there. The courts will throw it out eventually. But there's obviously a lot of grandstanding going on, and nobody's more of a grandstander than Darrell Issa. And then you've got now this committee is going ahead to look into Benghazi. And this is after you've had the State Department's Accountability Review Board, the Senate Intelligence Committee's hearing, the House Armed Services Committee's hearing, and the House Committee on Government Oversight and Reforms hearing. That was, of course, Darrell Issa's attempt to turn the so-called smoking gun into a real story. On the scale of absurdity and insanity, where would you put these latest two moves?
Well, I would only put them about a 5 or a 6. I would just have to disagree in that it's not a new crescendo of stupidity. It's pretty much what we've come to expect, and it's well-nigh irresistible for the Republicans going into an election year to grandstand this way as opposed to actually legislating.
Well, but what's the motive here? Are they doing this because they don't have anything to offer substantially on all the important issues that need to be addressed? Or are they doing this to rile up their base?
Well, I mean, it's a combination of both. You can't allow Paul Ryan to talk too much about his budget, or then he gets into voucherizing Medicare, and that will turn off the base of the base, which is the seniors who go out and, you know, near 100% rates to vote in midterm elections where other demographics do not. So it precisely is a matter of riling up the base and not talking about the things that they're not legislating on or their own economic policy, which is non-existent.
Well, there's no question that this IRS thing is incredibly bogus, and so is the Benghazi thing, but it's become so real to so many, because I guess if you watch Fox News and believe that that's actually a news channel, you have heard nothing but these two trumped-up cases, And, you know, the thing about the IRS so-called scandal that's so ridiculous is that, you know, the IRS were getting blitzed with unprecedented outbreak of applications for 501c4 tax-exempt social welfare vehicles because of the Citizens United decision. And they didn't know what to do with all these this blizzard of applications. So they decided to put in two categories into the computer to kind of sort them out to find out which were the legitimate ones and which were the nakedly partisan ones. So they put in the words Tea Party and they put in the words Progressive and Occupy. So, you know, they were clearly being bipartisan. So how have they managed to make this thing into some kind of jihad against the Tea Party?
Well, they do it simply because their base lives in a bubble. It only gets its quasi or pseudo information from Fox News. It's just the same way that Fox News is not going to tell you that other 501c4s were targeted, just as it's not going to tell you that Cliven Bundy was a deadbeat who cheated the government, or you could say you and me, as we're trustees for the government, as, in a sense, out of $1.1 million in grazing fees. They weren't going to tell you that. They were going to tell you he was standing up to federal overreach. So it's sort of par for the course. Now, the Washington Post, which is sort of the bulletin board of the Beltway Illuminati, covered the IRS story pretty much as it would a local story. And all of this came out that the IRS was inundated with these applications. It's an inevitable result of the Citizens United decision. I would say, opining a bit here, I think the whole nonprofit area, 501c3 or c4, is a huge part of the economy that effectively dodges taxes. Now, some of it is legitimate, some of it is charitable, and some of it is plainly bogus. It's a way to avoid taxation, which puts a greater burden on small business and individual taxpayers who don't get that kind of advantage. I mean, we even have defense contractors like Logistics Management Institute. They're contractors just like Halliburton, but they have incorporated as a nonprofit. Nonprofit hospitals don't have any better outcomes than for-profit hospitals. They don't do any more charitable work. They pay their hospital administrators and CEOs ridiculously high salaries, well into the seven figures. These don't really meet the definition of a nonprofit. I think the whole IRS flap could have been the occasion for a reasoned debate about what gets taxed in this country and what doesn't, and how insane the whole Citizens United decision was. But instead, it simply became a partisan witch hunt, and I'm no particular partisan for Lerner, the IRS commissioner, but she was within her rights to invoke the Fifth Amendment. And what the Republicans seem to be saying is that they can lift people's Fifth Amendment privilege against against incrimination. So it's awful from many aspects. One is a diversion from the real issues regarding nonprofits and so-called social welfare organizations, and the other for turning this into a McCarthyite witch hunt.
Again, I'm speaking with Mark Lofgren, who has spent 28 years working in Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate budget committees, which gave him ringside seats on TARP, Hurricane Katrina disaster relief, debates on the Pentagon budget, and the amazing antics of various deficit reduction commissions. He's the author of The Party Is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. And he has an important essay at billmoyes.com, Anatomy of the Deep State. So But the theatrical aspect of this, the bogus, phony aspect of this is, of course, I mean, this poor woman's going to have to spend a fortune on lawyers, and she had to resign. Her career's over. She'd probably have to sell a house and go into bankruptcy because of Daryl Issa's jihad. But at the end of the day, the courts will throw out any contempt charges because she's protected by the Fifth Amendment, the very thing that she invoked twice.
That is correct. So I fail to see why we're going down this path other than for cheap advantage and to avoid talking about real issues and instead having something to stir up one's political base.
So on the other piece of the theater of the absurd, which is this Benghazi thing that they've now gone ahead with, Boehner resisted it, but then he put Trey Gowdy in charge of it. And Trey Gowdy is, of course, a Tea Party Republican who has said some pretty he's given to conspiracy theories, and he believes that there is a conspiracy theory here, and there's a systematic effort on the part of the Democrats and the White House, in particular the Obama administration, to cover up this so-called Benghazi conspiracy. And obviously, they simply cannot make the distinction between government incompetence and conspiracy. And there certainly is a lot of questions about what happened in Benghazi, but they do seem to all indicate an incredible incompetence. And after we spend all these billions on intelligence, these people can't get out of their own way. But Gowdy apparently has said that we'll have committee hearings until the Lord comes back, if that's what it takes. So,
well, at least he shows he's a good Tea Party Republican. He believes in the rapture.
So is Boehner putting this nutcase in charge? Is this his revenge, do you think?
I don't know whether he just gave up and said, okay, I'll give you what you want, or he calculated, okay, I'll give you a horse doctor's dose of what you want and then see how you like it. Because this Gowdy fellow seems like he might be wrapped a little too tight, and on one of the morning talk shows this week, he was referring to the upcoming hearings he plans to hold as a trial, and he was the prosecutor. So I don't know whether that was a Freudian slip or whether that was the way he planned to conduct them, because we do have trials in America that are conducted under an adversarial system with the prosecutor presenting his own case. Investigative oversight hearings in Congress, on the other hand, are supposed to be fact-finding investigations, not trials. So he probably needs to read that little pocket constitution that all these would-be James Madisons have in their coat pocket.
So, Mike Lofgren, now that the train is going to leave the station and that we're going to have this ridiculous theater of Trey Gowdy and the Republicans beating this dead horse over Benghazi, and I don't imagine after this will be the fifth inquiry now whether anything will come to light. Obviously, the subtext here is that they're trying to go after Hillary Clinton, and of course the other subtext is to drum up the base and getting excited and get them out to vote based on this idea that something terrible happened with the death of four Americans in Benghazi. Of course, these are the same Republicans who've never, ever had an inquiry into why 4,500 Americans died needlessly in Iraq based on lies, and not to mention, hundreds of thousands, perhaps, of Iraqis who've died. Has anybody pointed that out, that inconsistency out?
Other than you and I talking about an hour ago on the same subject privately, I don't think very many people have. Perhaps the Republicans have sort of updated Stalin's observation that one death is a tragedy, a million are a statistic. Now it's four deaths are a scandal. and 4,500 are Ameristatistic. Again, but like the IRS matter, there is an opportunity for a useful debate about American foreign policy. That's just not what we're going to get. We should have been asking the question of why we intervened, spending about $1 billion in the operation to knock over Gaddafi with military force and take over a country. Instead of asking that, we're concentrating on one regrettable, tragic incident that was almost inevitable, it or something like it, once you overthrow a country. All the bad things that happened in Iraq principally occurred after the fighting was over with Saddam Hussein's army. All the things that happened that were so horrible in Afghanistan happened after the Taliban had been chased out, primarily, in early 2002. People just do not understand the concept of blowback, and Republicans like Lindsey Graham and John McCain, who were cheerleading and trying to badger Obama into doing this, not that Obama doesn't bear responsibility for his own actions, but these people are now crying about what a horrible outcome it was for something that they advocated and cheerled. So I think it's totally outrageous. Perhaps the only good that will be come out of this is that Gowdy will be so difficult to control that things will come out of the hearing that aren't quite in the script. They're maybe not convenient for the administration by any means, but they're not convenient for the Republicans or the military-industrial complex about all the stuff that Seymour Hersh has recently been writing about in the London Review of Books, that there was a little gun-running operation going on using the former equipment from Gaddafi's huge arsenal and shipping it via Benghazi to Turkey and thence into Syria or via Kuwait or Qatar. So that was some of the stuff that's the background of Benghazi that somehow they never point out in congressional hearings or on Fox News, that there was a lot of really questionable stuff going on there. But that apparently isn't the scandal. The scandal is the talking points that Susan Rice used.
Well, do you think, though, just in closing, Mike Lofgren, that the Democrats will participate in this farce? They're not sure. On the one hand, they would like to embarrass the Republicans by just simply not showing up and pointing out the nakedly partisan nature of this farce. But on the other hand, some are arguing that they should join in to make the kind of points that you're making.
Yes, if they were capable of that sort of independent thought, that they could make a case that is both true and serving their own interests as a congressional investigative committee for its true purpose of finding out the facts, it might not necessarily square with what the administration wants to see come out, but I do rather doubt that they would do that. If they decided to actually participate, they'd presumably unify behind some sort of defend the administration at all cost thing, which really doesn't serve the public or the truth. And it doesn't really attack the Republicans in any significant way, because we know how the partisan lines have been drawn on this for almost 2 years.
Well, Mike Lofgren, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
I enjoyed talking to you.
Again, I've been speaking with Mark Lofken, who spent 28 years working in Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate budget committees, which gave him ringside seats on TARP, Hurricane Katrina disaster relief, debates on the Pentagon budget, and the amazing antics of various deficit reduction commissions. He's the author of The Party Is Over, Our Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and The Middle Class Got Shafted. And he has an important essay at BillMoyers.com, Anatomy of the Deep State. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back looking into the revival of polio and conspiracy theories about not vaccinating children.
Idiot wind blowing in through the front door. Idiot wind blowing in from the back. Idiot wind blowing in from every crevice, every crack. Nobody want to tell it like it is to each other. Like you would to a sister or a brother. Cut this out. Cosmopolitan style.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Seth Mnookin, who is the Associate Director of MIT's Graduate Program in Science Writing and a contributing writer at Vanity Fair. He's the author of the 2006 New York Times bestseller, Feeding the Monster, How Money, Smarts, and Nerve Took a Team to the Top, Hard News, the Scandals at the New York Times and Their Meaning for American Media. And his latest book is The Panic Virus, the True Story Behind the Vaccine Autism Controversy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Seth Mnookin.
Thank you so much for having me.
And polio has made a comeback. It was almost entirely eradicated. It was an epidemic that started particularly in the Victorian age and caused enormous amounts of death in Europe and the United States, but was successfully eradicated globally through the use of a vaccine. But now the World Health Organization has declared the spread of polio an international public health emergency with outbreaks in Asia, Africa, and the Middle East, needing, according to the WHO, needing a coordinated international response. So your book, of course, A Panic Virus, focuses on the panic over vaccines, largely generated by an English doctor who was essentially a fraud, a guy called Andrew Wakefield. So there's two sort of separate issues here, but they seem related. We have also here in the United States a revival of whooping cough, which is related to people not vaccinating their children. Of course, a part of the vaccination program is polio itself. It hasn't hit us yet, but surely it's a matter of time before polio hits us as well.
Well, I'm not sure that that's true. We were very close to eradication, or we're certainly talking about eradication within a decade of polio for polio worldwide a couple of years ago, and it is alarming that it has come back to the extent that it has. But it would be difficult for polio to get a foothold in this country right now, just because we do still have fairly good vaccine uptake rates. Polio hasn't been endemic in the U.S. in many, many years. So what we're seeing right now with polio is a small handful of countries where there were still some cases every year, it really flaring up into something of an epidemic. And I think one lesson that we can learn in the United States is what seems to be, at current day, a situation where we have all sorts of diseases essentially under control, like pertussis or whooping cough, like measles, like mumps and rubella. I think what this illustrates is how quickly that can change, and how scary and dangerous it is when we allow these very dangerous and oftentimes deadly infectious diseases to return to a population.
Well, polio is apparently in Pakistan, Cameroon, and Syria, and it's also on the list of the WHO, they include Afghanistan, Equatorial Guinea, Ethiopia, Iraq, Israel, Somalia, and Nigeria as posing an ongoing threat. But my understanding is, for example, Syria was polio-free for 14 years, and it was just recently reinfected with the virus from Pakistan, presumably one of the jihadis that have gone over there to fight. So what would then stop somebody from Pakistan bringing it here to the United States?
Well, the issue, I guess there are a couple of issues. One is just physical proximity. So obviously, you know, international borders mean less than they ever have, and people can obviously get on planes. But the physical proximity, the fact that we are surrounded by countries that are also polio-free is one thing. And the other thing is, if someone infected with polio came over to the United States, right now, such a high percentage of our population is vaccinated that it would be very difficult for the disease to get enough of a toehold so that it was then we were actively infecting new people in the United States from cases of the disease that had originated in the United States. So even though polio had been declared eliminated in Syria, Syria never had as high a percentage of the population vaccinated as we do today. So that's why it was at more risk when something like this happened, when you started to see outbreaks in some of the surrounding countries.
But isn't that the problem here, that our vaccination rates are declining largely because of misinformation and, you know, in effect, delusion, a lot of which came from this English doctor who, in league with some class action lawyers, came up with this link, or this supposed link between childhood vaccinations and autism, all of which has been completely disproved, and he's lost his medical license. And I think some of the lawyers are in jail, from my own recollection.
I'm not sure about the legal case. Certainly, he lost his medical license, and the paper that he published has been retracted. You're right. In a sense, what's really interesting, I think, and that's happening in the United States, is that if you look at the population as a whole, the vaccine uptake rates are still very strong, over 90% for most diseases. What we have definitely seen in the last 5 to 10 years is an increase in the number of communities where the vaccine uptake rate has declined to 80, 70, 60, even 50%. And in those communities, they then are incredibly susceptible to diseases, especially diseases like measles, which is the most infectious microbe known to humankind, and pertussis, which is also very, very, very infectious.
But my sense, Seth, is that since these childhood vaccinations involve basically a whole range of diseases are taken care of and prevented in these vaccinations that include chickenpox, diphtheria, measles, mumps, pertussis, whooping cough, polio, retrovirus, rubella, and tetanus. So given that pertussis is making a comeback and so is measles, and here in the state of California, you know, parents can sign a form that means their kids can come to school without having been vaccinated. There's a lot of concern amongst other parents that this is going to lead to outbreaks. So the fact that polio is a part of the mix, I know you've suggested that it's not likely to happen here, but if people are not immunizing their kids for whooping cough, they're also not immunizing their kids for polio.
Well, actually, it's one of the interesting things, and I think one of the sort of oddities of vaccine hesitancy and the anti-vaccine movement in the United States, is that it actually tends to focus on diseases that are still around and are still present in the U.S., which I would have made the exact same assumption that you did, which is if there are people who are delaying vaccines or skipping vaccines altogether, they would skip something like polio because we haven't had cases of polio in this country really for decades. But what we've actually seen is that it tends to be a couple of the combined vaccines, as you mentioned, the MMR vaccine, which is measles, mumps, and rubella, and then the DTP vaccine, which is diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis. that a lot of parents are either delaying or avoiding. I shouldn't say a lot of parents, that the parents who are delaying or avoiding vaccines are delaying or avoiding those two. And so you have this sort of somewhat, I guess, paradoxical situation where parents who are choosing not to vaccinate are choosing not to vaccinate their kids against the very diseases that they're going to be most susceptible to, which I guess is an illustration of how logic kind of doesn't come into play a lot in this situation, because if it did, then you wouldn't have this situation in the first place.
Well, I think you've hit on something key there, Seth Mnookin, and that is logic in this increasingly faith-based world that we live in. I've actually tried to convince parents that I know to immunize their kids, and they have been literally influenced by this phony English doctor study, or this doctor's phony study, I should say, that who now lost his medical license and was withdrawn from the Lancet. It's like the 9/11 truthers. Once they get this fixation in their head about Building 7 and the government's inside job, there seems to be nothing you can do about it. And that's what I find so extraordinary, is that this rigidity, this inflexibility, that where people dig their heels in, and just once they accept one of these bogus anti-scientific beliefs, you know, it's pretty hard to shake them.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I try and differentiate between the sort of conspiracy theorists, and there are certainly plenty of those in the anti-vaccine movement, and it sounds like you might have been speaking with some of those. The ones who believe that there's a giant cover-up, and for those type of people, any evidence that you give them supporting the fact that vaccines are safe and that there have been safety studies done tends only to reinforce their belief in the conspiracy, which is the exact same thing you see with 9/11 truthers. So, you know, you say, look, here's a study that shows that you don't need to be worried. And the response often is, well, why would you need to show me that study if there was nothing to worry about? It's a sort of logic vacuum that it's easy to fall down. With a larger portion of the population who have kind of picked up some of these fears or concerns almost by osmosis, because they've heard them on the playground or from other parents, or might have spotted a headline in a newspaper and didn't actually read the whole story, I think we do have a better chance of reaching those parents. But one issue we have right now is that there's not really an effective communication strategy. And I think we're also coming up against a real problem with the healthcare system as it currently exists. And that's that it's very difficult for doctors and for pediatricians to find the time to really sit down with parents and have a discussion with them about vaccines. You know, oftentimes wellness appointments are 15 minutes long, and you need to get, you know, X, Y, and Z done, or you're not going to get reimbursed for the appointment. And so when I talk to parents, one thing I hear often is parents saying, you know, I just don't feel like my doctor is listening to me. And when I talk to doctors, they often say, we just don't have time to have these discussions. And I think that's a very crucial problem that we need to try and kind of work our way out of, or it's possible the situation is going to get worse.
Well, one of the paradoxes of trying to argue with people who are putting their children at risk by not vaccinating them is that they will say, well, you know, these diseases have been eradicated, so why should we bother? And that's at the heart of the problem, because somehow other people don't understand the herd concept.
Right, exactly. So, one thing you can tell them certainly is that there's only one disease that's been eradicated, and that is smallpox. All the other diseases, and we're not vaccinated against smallpox. So all the diseases that we are vaccinated against are currently still around in the world, certainly. And most of them are around in the United States. It is vaccines. There is this sort of paradox where vaccines almost seem to be a victim of their own success. So, you know, the more effective they are, the less often you see these diseases, and the less often you see them, the more parents start to feel like, well, you know, I don't know anyone who's ever had measles, or I don't know anyone who's ever, you know, been blinded because of rubella. I do think that is a real issue. Unfortunately, you know, just in the past 2 or 3 years, we've seen how quickly that can change, because there have been some of the largest outbreaks of measles in decades, and these outbreaks have been growing both in number and in number of patients. And one thing that I think everyone can and should really be concerned about, even if your children are vaccinated, even if you don't have children or your children are all old and out of the house, is that when there is one of these measles outbreaks, it's incredibly, incredibly expensive to contain. And there was a study actually done based on a San Diego measles outbreak in 2008 that found that containing each individual case costs more than $10,000. You know, as everyone knows, we're not living in a time of budget surpluses. And so when you have a local public health authority that's spending tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars on something that's really totally unnecessary, I think that's cause of concern for everyone, because that's all money that can and should be spent towards other things that need the attention.
Well, Seth Manoogian, in terms of the outbreak of polio coming back in Pakistan, as we know that some of the health workers have been murdered by the Taliban, and a lot of that was in response to the fact that the CIA used polio vaccine as a cover to get the DNA from the household where bin Laden was hiding. And, you know, I've heard reports in the Pakistani press essentially blaming the CIA for the return of polio. But in this country, how much can you hold people like Jenny McCarthy and Oprah Winfrey culpable?
I think you can hold them fairly culpable. You know, Jenny McCarthy has been a very effective spokesperson for this mistaken notion that vaccines cause autism. She's been incredibly vocal about it, and one of the ways she's been able to be so vocal about it is because she's been given access to some of the most popular shows on TV, like the Oprah Winfrey Show. I actually think it's in some ways more irresponsible of Oprah than of Jenny McCarthy, because I try to give people the benefit of the doubt, and so I'm going to try and assume that Jenny is a mother who actually is, all she's trying to do is do what she believes is best for her child. Oprah really functions both as a television personality and to some extent as a journalist. And I think what she did in really legitimizing what was not a legitimate viewpoint on multiple occasions with Jenny McCarthy was abhorrent, and something that she really should be quite ashamed of.
Well, Seth Manoogian, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Seth Manoogian, who is an associate director of MIT's graduate program in science writing and a contributing editor at Vanity Fair. He's the author of the 2006 New York Times bestseller, Feeding the Monster, How Money, Smarts, and Nerve Took a Team to the Top, and Hard News, The Scandals at the New York Times and Their Meaning for American Media. And his latest book is The Panic Virus, The True Story Behind the Vaccine Autism Controversy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.